This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good evening, I'm Umar Paganampake Pagan, and this is the Evening Edition. At least once a day, a child is exposed to a form of violence, whether as a victim or as a witness. The impact will leave a physical, emotional, and mental mark on them, one that they will carry for years. Recent data coming out of UNICEF says that nearly half of children aged 12 to 23 months are subjected to corporal punishment at home, and a similar proportion are exposed to verbal abuse. Worldwide, the most recent surveys indicate that 9 million girls aged 15 to 19 were forced into sexual intercourse or other sexual acts within the past year, and deaths are becoming more common in adolescence. What kind of society do we live in when we're exposing children to such violence? More importantly, why do we let it happen? Why do we look away when we see a parent or guardian verbally or physically abuse a child? Education begins with us, the adults, and there's one person who's pushing for this globally.
I'm Marta Santos-Pais, and I work in the United Nations as Special Representative of the Secretary General on Violence Against Children. I'm a lawyer. I'm from Portugal originally, and I have been dealing with children's rights for a number of years.
Ms. Pais, thanks for making the time for us despite your busy schedule. You're an independent advocate for the elimination of all kinds of violence against children, and you've also authored some publications on the subject. Why does this mean so much to you?
Well, it's very hard to be indifferent to, a child who is suffering, who is traumatized. And I think it touches the heart of any person when we see it closely. Certainly growing up and having, been exposed to the situation of other children in my own country made me feel very sensitive to the issue. But growing up as a lawyer and getting involved in cases where this was a topic of concern, of course, made me strongly committed to trying to support victims, but more importantly, try to help prevent violence from occurring. And very often, in most cases, violence can be prevented. So when we feel that it is such a missed opportunity, when cases affect so dramatically so many millions of children around the world, of course, you feel very frustrated and impatient because you can do something about it. And you need to join your voice to the many others who are promoting the same cause of ensuring that children can grow up in an environment that is caring, that is nurturing, that is providing the right affection and modeling behavior in a manner that is non-violent. So children mirror that non-violent behavior in their own life when they engage with their friends and peers and later in life with their own family.
In what other ways does violence present itself, especially when we're dealing with children? There's physical abuse, there's verbal abuse, but violence against children comes in many forms.
Well, violence can be manifested in many different ways. As you said, physical violence is obviously something that very often leaves bruises, so people get to understand that it has happened. You may kick a child or hit a child or use a caning to punish or correct a child. That is obviously non-acceptable. Emotional violence is very often difficult to identify, but if you humiliate a child and make the child feel unvalued and unrecognized, of course, that may leave scars that may last even longer. And it's very hard to identify, and very often it's very hard for the child even to explain what goes on. But other forms include sexual abuse. And as you know, unfortunately, sexual abuse happens in many circumstances. It happens within the home. It happens in school. It happens on the way to school. And it happens even when children are placed in institutions for their care and protection. And it is, unfortunately, a topic that is associated with so much sense of shame that it becomes very difficult for the child to speak about it. But more dramatically, very often authorities, officials, professionals tend to dismiss the cases, and in a way perceive it as something that the child is not very, articulate in telling the story, and therefore it's probably not even to believe, and the child makes more of it than reality shows. Unfortunately, it's very widespread and quite unacceptable. But we have today other different forms of violence. You know, for instance, online abuse has become, as you know, a very tangible concern for kids. In many countries, children are starting earlier to use information communication technologies. They stay longer online. And it's obviously that places them also at the risk of predators, of those who groom them, who try to seduce them, to show photos of themselves naked or to use a webcam to show them. And very often children either feel seduced or do not realize the danger that is associated with it. They believe it's probably someone very far away and so nothing else will ever happen. But the truth is that those images can be replicated, they can be put on the cyberspace and stay there forever. And very often the predators and those who try to exploit the child know where the child lives, where the child goes to school, the community to which the child belongs. And unfortunately, there are cases where the child ends up being raped by those predators. So there are continuing forms, of course, not necessarily always of a sexual nature. As we know, online abuse may also implicate cyberbullying, just spreading rumors about someone that spread around the world, or posting images that may be, creating a sense of guilt or shame for the child concerned, may be extremely traumatic for that child. I know that in this region, trafficking is another form of violence that is raising a lot of concern amongst governments within Asia. So what is dramatic is that violence may have many faces, but what is even more dramatic is that very often a victim is in fact a multiple victim of different forms of violence. It is a victim of emotional violence together with physical violence, and sometimes accompanied by sexual abuse or online abuse, and therefore it grows by itself. And we need always to think about that tower of fear that is created around the child when we address an incident of violence. It's always a tip of the iceberg.
When we come back, Ms. Pius will be talking about how we should initiate the awareness and education. Keep it here on BFM 89.9.
Banish fraudulent maneuvers. BFM 89.9.
This is the Evening Edition with me, Uma Paganampake Pagan, where we're talking about putting an end to violence against children. My guest is Ms. Marta Santos Paez. She's the UN Special Representative of the Secretary General of Violence Against Children. It's her job to talk to communities and governments and educate them about what needs to be done to curb childhood violence. Ms. Paez, there's no doubt that education needs to start early, but how do we do that, especially in a society that doesn't recognize abusive behavior? They may look at the way they bring up their children as how my parents did it, and there's no recognition of what they're doing is wrong.
Yeah, you're very right when you say we need to start as early as possible. And starting in early childhood means that you can model the behavior of the parents in an affectionate, nurturing, caring manner. And the child naturally replicates the model the child sees. If mother and father are very friendly and supportive and ready to, discuss issues, being respectful rather than being violent, of course, for the child, that provides a tool that the child is going to use as the child grows in school or in the community or as a family member. But when we fail to do that and we expose the child in very early stages of the child's life to a violent environment, not only we are affecting and compromising the development of that child, including the brain development of the child, but in addition, we are giving a model of solving problems, conflicts, tensions, divergent opinions through violent means, which is, of course, a way of just seeing violence grow by itself rather than putting an end to it. So how can we address it? Certainly we can address it at many different moments. We can address it through the education system. I mean, thinking about the discussions that can take place within the classroom, the games that can be promoted in the playground, the respect that one shows for a child who has a disability, who comes from another country and doesn't speak well the language that is used in the school. These are each and every moments where you can really convey a message of respect and of tolerance that certainly will help curtail risks for violence. But it also entails investment in programs for future parents or existing parents to understand, first to understand the negative impact on the child of using violence as a form of discipline or correction or education. I mean, explaining to a father and mother that this may affect the development of the brain of the child, that it may affect the physical and emotional health of the child, that it may limit the ability to learn well in school, to relate positively to others with confidence rather than through fear. All of this is very important through parenting programs. And of course, if we think about the many professionals that surround the life of children, you know, starting with the birth attendant, the nurse, the pediatrician, the medical doctor who does the vaccines for the children, each and every can be an ambassador of this nonviolence cause rather than just the technical expert that does its job and nothing else is associated with that moment. Teachers play an absolutely fundamental role. We have seen, for instance, that children feel that bullying is a very big concern for them in their lives. But if the teachers seem to be indifferent to the bullying happening in the school, if they pretend not to see it and prefer not to intervene, to let children understand those who commit bullying that it is wrong and there are other ways of solving problems, and the victims that they should be able and feel empowered to tell their stories and share their trauma and seek help rather than keep the suffering within themselves. You know, again, teachers can be very active actors in modeling nonviolent behavior in the classroom, for instance, by not using corporal punishment or caning, or by being a positive presence in solving tensions and solving conflicts and showing peaceful ways of addressing. But I could go on my list, you know, thinking about lawyers or judges or social workers. I mean, each and every professional can play a very important role. But as you said, how do we help families realize this is not right? Not only by educating, it's also we also need some surveillance kind of mechanisms within the community, institutions that can receive complaints where incidents are serious and need to be investigated and addressed. And this is not the aim is not to punish people. The most important aim is to help the victim, is to help the child overcome the trauma, the suffering, and recover and look at life with confidence and hope rather than feeling absolutely left on his or her own. In some serious cases, of course, investigation is needed and punishment is required. And certainly situations of sexual abuse and online abuse are an important example in that regard. But what I'm trying to say is that it is an area where each and every can make a difference. And in our roles as parents, as professionals, as members of government or parliament or members of human rights institutions or members of our community, we can make a contribution by raising awareness, by standing for the right principles, by showing positive options that are an alternative rather than being in complicity through our silence or through condoning situations of violence.
Bringing it back to Malaysia, I think many of us can't see how education and awareness will work here, given our culture and perhaps an Asian mindset that the harder we are with our children, the tougher they'll be and the better they'll turn out. Corporal punishment is still widely practiced and we're still warming up to any form of displays of affection with our children. If we were to drop an awareness program, where would we even start?
Well, we need to start everywhere. Certainly, public information, awareness raising Addressing everybody is very important. And, you know, in many studies that we have conducted in many parts of the world, we have seen that parents may resort to corporal punishment or teachers may resort to corporal punishment. But when they are asked whether they think it's useful and effective or why do they think it persists as a practice, most of the time they say, because we don't know of any other way of addressing the issue of educating children, disciplining children. So it is upon us to show that there are other ways, that there are other options and alternatives. And when we talk to parents or future parents about good parenting programs that in fact help the family become more united and cohesive, more ready to, you know, confront difficulties in life, as a unit rather than individuals that are there and suffering on their own, that is already a very important step. Of course, we need the leadership of the leaders of any country. We need the leadership of teachers in the school, those who show by example that there are other ways that do not resort to corporal punishment or to caning within the school system, those that create platforms for children to tell how deeply devastated they feel when an incident of violence takes place and how they feel not only affected on the moment where the violence incident takes place, but for such a long time, sometimes for life, and how difficult it is for them to take advantage of the world and contribute to the world and to life when they are so traumatized and so undermined. But I think very often, you know, we also miss the other dimension that sometimes talks strongly to governments, which is the economic cost of using violence as a way of disciplining children. Globally, we know that violence against children costs 8% of the global GDP. This is $7 trillion per year. That's a huge amount of money. In the Asian region, it's more than $200 billion. So if we think about how countries could use available resources to invest in prevention, to invest in early childhood programs, good parenting programs, creating positive content in the education, programs where people learn about the importance of respecting others or solving conflicts differently, then I think the return for society would be so much higher and certainly the costs would be so much lower. And what we have seen is that if this investment starts in early childhood, it really multiplies by many, many millions. So the opportunity is huge and we need to put this topic high, certainly in the policy agenda of each country, but also in the public debate, so that it doesn't get too emotional and divisive, but on the contrary, there is an opportunity to bridge the differences and to see what a nation can do together. We saw this happening in many other parts of the world, you know. Well, certainly in this big region, New Zealand has an important legislation forbidding the use of corporal punishment. In countries like Sweden or Norway, we have seen the same. In Latin America, many countries are doing this. And what has happened is that by introducing a piece of legislation and investing in information, awareness raising, capacity building, the number of cases of violence against children have been visibly lower and lower over time. And if we think that we can, you know, move towards non-violence at all, we used to say we like zero violence to be the world's favorite number because that will be the moment where we will celebrate really the best possible childhood, then we are getting there if we really invest. And as you know, now this is not only an international obligation in the light of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which of course is in force in Malaysia, but it is also a mandatory requirement with the adoption of the new Sustainable Development Agenda, which identified as a key target the elimination of all forms of violence against children, including within the home, so everywhere. So we would like to see Malaysia lead by example in this regard. You know, we think that the country has the capacity, the intellectual force to do it. It has certainly the resources required to invest in services that can make a difference. And we would like to see the nation embracing this as a common priority for everyone.
After the news, Ms. Pius talks to us about how a body like the UN can actually help in combating this issue of violence against children. Stay tuned. This is the Evening Edition on BFM 89.9.
Bring forth Moolah, BFM 89.9.
Good evening. This is the Evening Edition with me, Uma Panganampike Pagan. Miss Marta Santos Pais joins me this evening. She's the UN Special Representative of the Secretary General of Violence Against Children, and we're addressing the issues behind why children are exposed to violence, why we, the adults, allow it to happen, and what we can do to stop it. Some alarming statistics coming out from a recent UNICEF report titled Violence in the Lives of Children and Adolescents shows that 3/4 of children aged 2 to 4 worldwide, that's close to 300 million children, are regularly subjected to violent discipline. So that's any physical punishment and or psychological aggression by their parents or other caregivers at home. 250 million are subjected to physical punishment. Many children are also indirectly affected by violence in the home. Worldwide, 1 in 4 children under the age of 5 live with a mother who has been a recent victim of intimate partner violence. The numbers are staggering and frightening, which is why the UN has been championing to fight this and paving the way is Ms. Pius. Ms. Pius, tell me, how would a body like the UN steer governments and communities in the right direction? How do you get the buy-in from countries to embark on this seriously?
Well, there are different things. I mean, the first thing is to, of course, discuss with the government and share good practices from other countries and in strategies that have really worked, like the examples I was given a moment ago from the Nordic European countries, for instance, or New Zealand or in Latin American countries. We like to share good examples. You know, the UN doesn't impose sanctions. The UN is a platform where we can all learn from the best that is available in the world and providing the right expertise. But the second thing we like to do, and we will continue to do, is also to mobilize the political will of each and every nation to invest in the right way to prevent and address violence against children. And we know that there is a very simple combination of strategies that work. It has 3 dimensions. The first one is that this needs to be identified as a priority for the country, of course. We cannot impose people changing their mindset. We need the adherence of the country. But we need an agenda to lead us to a platform where violence will not be a reality. And until the moment where we have a clear policy agenda that identifies this as a major goal and identifies what the education system can do, what the health sector can contribute, what justice and home affairs can do, all together around the child and the prevention of violence, we will not go far. So a policy agenda is fundamental, and we would like to see Malaysia adopting one very soon with a very clear goal. Secondly, we need clear legislation, and the legislation needs to be implemented, but it needs to convey a clear message that it's not negotiable and it's not acceptable to ill-treat children. Physically, emotionally, sexually, online, in whatever context and in whatever form. And that will help generate a different kind of debate in society and perhaps mobilize better capacity building, more resources invested to prevention. Otherwise, it will not happen. And the third thing we need is to have transparent and accurate data that tells us about the magnitude of violence and the impact on children of violence against children. And the truth is that at the moment, we don't have, in fact, the integrated picture provided by data in Malaysia. Again, I believe that there is a very strong intellectual and policy capacity to make this happen, and it would be very important to do so that we can invest in the areas that need greater support. Now, I'm saying all of this because, as you know, all countries are expected to report to the United Nations on how they are addressing these issues. First, to tell about the important steps taken in Malaysia, you know, to achieve non-violence in childhood. But secondly, to identify self-critically what are the areas where more investment is required. Secondly, as you know, Malaysia is a party to the Convention on the Rights of the Child. And also in that regard, it's a UN committee that deals with children's issues, including violence against children. So in that context, Malaysia is due to report to the Committee on the Rights of the Child on what it has taken, the measures taken so far to prevent and address violence against children. Unfortunately, the report is slightly overdue, but of course it's never too late to submit it, and we would hope that this report would give an opportunity for the authorities in Malaysia to reflect on what has been done and what needs to happen, you know, in the future. So by providing advice and technical assistance, of course, the UN is ready to support and engage. But we would like, again, to see Malaysia lead by example. And within ASEAN, as a member state of ASEAN, there is a regional commitment to end all forms of violence against children adopted at the heads of summit of heads of state 2 years ago. And therefore, it's more than normal that, you know, our expectations are high and our confidence that Malaysia will take it very seriously is also high.
Now, what has gripped Malaysia in the wake of sexual violence was the emergence of child sexual predator Richard Huckle. He was under the radar for so long, living with poor communities and preying on their children for some time. While stringent measures are being put in place now, there still is that touchy subject of having sex education taught to children for them to realize what's wrong and what's right. Would you agree that it's one of the important steps to consider in all of this?
Well, certainly it is an important strategy. It's not the magic wand that will solve the problem. I think it's more complex than that. But of course, I always think children need to be the first line of prevention. You know, they cannot be the victims that recurrently we find in data and in cases before the police of each country. And if we empower and inform children to know where the risks may lay and what they can do, what are the institutions ready to advise and to support them, the opportunities for predators, like the case that you have mentioned, will not happen so easily. But of course, we need to sensitize the community. I mean, a case like the one you have described has also happened because people didn't seem to see what was going on. And in a way, the children were the victims. But perhaps there could have been a stronger surveillance system in the community that could perhaps have intervened quicker. But we also have to have a better legislative framework. You know, it's important that we recognize that cooperation between different law enforcement agencies across border is very visible, that persons like the offender that you describe could be prosecuted in different parts of the world, otherwise perhaps he would not have been identified. And it is important to have in place services to support the recovery and reintegration of the child survivors. Because if that doesn't happen, rather than being one incident, you know, it is going to be a scar for life. And associated with the social pressure, with the sense of shame and the sense of disbelief and the isolation that child victims feel, it will be very often a dramatic, indication that child is not going to be a successful adult. And we cannot afford not to invest in these children to give them a second chance of hope and belief in the world. And unfortunately, in many, many cases, we just see these children become re-victimized over and over again. And sometimes they don't think that they are valued by society. Some of them may even think that the only option they have is to become associated with networks of prostitution or other things that certainly are not good for them. Sometimes we have more dramatic outcomes with suicide being a solution. So we really need to think about the dramatic future that may happen or the future with hope that we can help shape. And I'm confident this will be part of the picture here in Malaysia.
Now, given what you've done and what you're planning to do in this area, what do you hope is achieved in the next 5 years? Will we get any closer to having a violence-free childhood?
You know, I First of all, I would hope that early childhood care and development would be identified around the world as a real priority, a priority that is discussed by different departments in government and that is supported by a strong social protection system that helps families address challenges that limit their abilities to support their children, investment in stimulation for the little kids, including through care centers where they have professionals well trained to take care of the children. And when we invest this way, we know that the opportunity for violence will be reduced, but the opportunity for happy families and happy children will certainly be multiplying. And as we have seen proven by even a Nobel economy, a Nobel Prize, the investment in early childhood can bring such a high social return. And the investment is going to be multiplying by many, many, many fold. And the societies can be more cohesive. There will be less discrimination, less deprivation, less violence. And therefore, I'm hoping that within 5 years, this priority in the Sustainable Development Agenda will be reflected in the agenda of each and every country, and resources will be made available to support implementation of these programs. I'm hoping that I'm not dreaming too much, but that is really something that I am very ambitious for.
I certainly hope so, too. Thank you so much. My thanks to Marta Santos-Payas, the UN Special Representative of the Secretary General of Violence Against Children. If you've missed any part of this program, you can download this podcast on our BFM app, which you can get off the Apple App Store and on Google Play. Stay tuned for more programming after the 7 p.m. news right here on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.